Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Laham Harkov, and I'm here with Jerusalem Post editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz.
Hello.
We're here on a very eventful political week. After it was announced last week that Yair Lapid has managed to throw together a coalition, which will be led by Naftali Bennett of Yamina in the beginning, the coalition agreements just came out, or at least a draft of them, and we will have a vote to bring in this new government on Sunday. There's a lot to discuss.
So this is the final countdown, if we could call it that, to Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year run as prime minister. These are the final days, assuming that that vote passes on Sunday.
And at this point, it looks like it's going to pass because the Yamina Knesset members who were kind of wobbly on this issue have now come out and said that they will vote to support this new government.
So we're going to have a jam-packed show. We're going to talk with Gil Hoffman, our longtime veteran political analyst, about what this new government is shaping up to be. He'll give us some insight into the coalition agreements and the different policies that they're going to advance. And we're also going to speak with Jeremy Salton, who was a candidate on the Yamina party list, was the head of their English campaign during the last four elections, and might be getting a role, we're not sure, inside the Bennett administration.
I'd be surprised if he doesn't. He's been so loyal to him for so many years.
He has been loyal, but politics and loyalty don't always go together, Lahav, as we've seen over
True.
The years. But Lahav, in Bibi's last few days, possibly, as prime minister, sum up for us, if you can, in a few sentences, What does this mean for Netanyahu, and where's he going from here?
Well, I think that Netanyahu is going to go to the opposition. Opposition leader is a position in Israel that by law is almost equivalent to a cabinet minister in its sort of status, not in its influence, but certainly in its status. And every time Prime Minister Bennett gives a speech in the Knesset, Netanyahu will be able to give a response speech. And believe me, he is going to give a response. He's going to be a constant thorn in the side of this coalition, which is both small, only 61 seats, and it is very diverse. And so it looks shaky. Now, they're very, very motivated to keep Netanyahu out of office, but Netanyahu will try to topple it any way he can so that he can make a quick return to power.
Even though his trial will still be going on during this whole period.
Right, and it's a question of timing. If this coalition manages to hold on for more than, a year and a half, they're going to pass a budget now right away, within 100 days. I would say if it is able to pass the next budget, then I think Netanyahu's chances of coming back will be much smaller, both because his star will fade to some extent, and also because of the trial. But if it falls before that, he might be able to make a comeback.
Now, you and I, some of our listeners who might have heard our last podcast last week, it was short, but I think it was to the point. We recorded it at the airport as we were taking off back to Israel from Dubai. Both of us were in Dubai for the Global Investment Forum that the Jerusalem Post put together with the Emirati Khalij Times newspaper based in Dubai. It was a fantastic conference, very successful, beautiful, and moving to see Emiratis and Israelis and people from around the world coming together to talk business and cooperation and partnerships. But one thing that I heard, and I know that you heard as well, were from locals there, as well as other people across the region and Asia, who said to me, "You guys are nuts. If you don't want BB, send him to our country. We'll be happy to take him. He's an amazing leader. He's strong. He has a great global and prominence and stature. What's wrong with Israelis that they want to get rid of Netanyahu?"
Like, as an Israeli, I have a lot of hakarat hatov, appreciation for a lot of things that Netanyahu has done for us. And those are the things that I think these people are seeing. And that includes, being an instrumental part in making the Abraham Accords happen, that we now have diplomatic relations with four more Arab countries. And it was for the first time in 26 years. And you saw how genuine and warm the relations are with Emiratis just last week. But Netanyahu's also been instrumental in transforming Israel's economy. Our quality of life is really great here. We've had some of our most quiet and secure years here. Now, arguably, there's been some consequences to that sort of maintaining the status quo in the conflict with the Palestinians that, we still have these problems and they haven't been solved. But you can't take it away from Netanyahu that these have been extremely quiet years relative to the past. And so those are all the reasons that Netanyahu keeps winning elections, of course. But of course, at the same time, his critics point out, number one, he's on trial for many counts of corruption. Number two, he over the years, his rhetoric has become more and more
divisive
and also just like undermining the basic institutions of government. You know, he's been tilting more and more towards an illiberal,
almost a Trumpian type of style of governing.
Yes. And I think I used to really resist comparing Netanyahu to Trump. First of all, because I think some things that we call Trumpy, Netanyahu was doing before Trump came along. For example, he never liked the media. But also, I think that Netanyahu was very qualified to be prime minister. He also served our country with distinction as a soldier, you know, in Sayar Makal. But I think that Netanyahu, over time, actually adopted some of the things Trump did intentionally because he saw it works.
That speech that he gave on Sunday, Lahav, where he spoke about that this is the greatest election fraud in Israeli history, that people are being cheated, that we need to, in Hebrew he said, lekanes bahem, right? To stick it to them,
yeah,
to the media.
To me, like,
that's like the steal.
Exactly. To me, I tweeted that there was a different Knesset member in Likud who said similar things, and I said, to me, all I hear is stop the steal.
Right.
I don't think that he's inciting to violence. I do think that there are other people who support Netanyahu who have said really bad things, and they've used the term traitor.
Suicide, that Naftali Bennett and Gideon Sar are suicide bombers was a comment that was made by one member of his party. I don't think that he's inciting to violence, and he was clear to pay lip service to the call from the head of the Shabak, the Israel Security Agency, who warned on Saturday that this uptick in incitement could lead to bloodshed. And he paid that lip service, and he said, when he said stick it to them, he said, of course, within the confines of the law. But there could be some crazy lunatic out there who could decide to take the matters into their own hands. I'm sorry, but that's happened before.
Yeah. I mean, never in my personal sort of life have I seen people be so hysterical about the politics. And maybe it's because I've not been living in America during the Trump years, because I know people were very hysterical then. But I used to see these articles where they'd be like, how to talk to your crazy uncle about Trump at the Thanksgiving table. And I would like be like, you just talk to your uncle. But now I know people who are completely hysterical about this. And I just
feel cheated. They feel like they've been ripped off, which to me, you know, having covering Netanyahu as we have for so many years, right? He was never, I mean, you know, he would say A and he would do B. He would put on these appearances of being right wing, and he would bring left wing parties into his coalition. He promises to pass a two-year budget. He reneges on it. I mean, there's a lot of different things that he said he would do, which he doesn't end up doing. Why are they suddenly surprised that Bennett and Ayelet Shaked, who said they wouldn't sit with Yair Lapid, also said they wouldn't let a fifth election happen, have decided, okay, we're choosing one of the promises that we've made? I mean, where were Israeli voters all these years that this is what shocks them?
You know, that's politics, right? In politics, you have to compromise. But you could say whatever you want, you know, like the Likud accuses Netanyahu, the Likud accuses Bennett and Shaked of lying to the voters. But every politician lies to their voters.
And
Netanyahu has done it time and again, and so has everyone else. And I have to say also with this whole thing that Bennett said he wouldn't sit in a government led by Lapid. Bennett lifted up a piece of paper and said, I signed, like, if you sign this, then it will be a contract. And Netanyahu never signed it. So as far as I know, if only one side signs a contract and not the other, it's not a binding contract.
I hear that. But on the other hand, the symbolic gesture of, you know, signing something that says I won't sit with Lapid, and also saying, he said it in Hebrew, lo berotatsia and lo bemutatsia, right? Not in a rotation, not in a mutation would he sit with Lapid. And clearly he is joining with Lapid. But I do think is that, you know, like you said, politics, the art of compromise, this is how it goes. But something that does sadden me, and, you know, I haven't ever, I never hid my criticism of Netanyahu, and I think it is time for him to go. And I am hopeful that this coalition, which I've called the Kaleidoscope Coalition because it's all over the place, and with its colors and diversity, does succeed. And on paper, it's a beautiful idea, bringing left and right and Arabs and everyone together. I hope and pray it works. But I do think what you just said before is sad. And which part is that? Is that politics, just get used to the fact that people say one thing and they do something else. We should be able to believe what people stand for and what they say they stand for, right? And you see that across the board. I mean, Israel's not necessarily unique to this. But it does, it causes an erosion of trust within our government and within our political system. And I mean, it's, Ben, it's not to blame, Netanyahu's not to blame, it's everyone who's to blame for this situation, right? They all say one thing and they do something else. And that is, you know, Benny Gantz said he would never sit with Netanyahu, and then he went into a coalition with Netanyahu, right? So they all say things, but I think of my kids, think of your kids, right? And they're looking upwards and they see these people who they can't believe what they're saying. What does that say for our future?
Yeah, I mean, it is sad. I also think that there are two kinds of promises where, like, Bennett promising he won't sit with Lapid, that is truly completely in his control at the end of the day. But, like, Lieberman, who promised that, like, within 2 days of becoming defense minister, he would take out Ismail Haniyeh, that was never in his control.
48 hours, right?
Yeah, that was never in his control. It was, like, a stupid promise to begin with, and he probably shouldn't have said it. But on the other hand, like, there are certain things that people say they want to campaign, and then when they see the full picture, they realize they can't do it.
That was
it.
The famous Ariel Sharon comment, right? Mashori mi po,
lori mi sham.
Things you see from here as prime minister, you didn't see from there when you were outside. And I think that to an extent is happening to Bennett. You know, he's having to move maybe to the center and to recalibrate where he's going. So, like we said, we got a jam-packed show. We're going to hear from Gil Hoffman, our political analyst, about the coalition agreement and what's next. And Jeremy Salton, one of the candidates for the Amina Party, might find his way into the Knesset, but probably before that, somewhere into the Bennett administration. I almost said Biden administration, those bees. But here we go. Gil, great to have you with us. So on Sunday, the government gets sworn in, right? From that moment, if I understand correctly, Naftali Bennett becomes prime minister. Benjamin Netanyahu leaves the prime minister's office. We don't have this transition period, and Lahav has written about this like we see traditionally in the United States. What does Bennett do? First moment, he gets into office. What does he do? How does he run this government?
First of all, he makes sure that Netanyahu is really gone.
Well, gone to the opposition, at least.
Just not in power anymore.
Okay.
Then that is the goal of this government. It has been accomplished. That's it. They don't really need to do anything anymore in the eyes of the people who brought them to power. But Bennett really does have an agenda. He really does have, first of all, an agenda of healing the country after Netanyahu, after a pandemic, and after a war in Gaza. So there are steps that will be taken toward national reconciliation that might not mean a lot to people around the world, but to the people who live here day in and day out. They do find that very important, and that's what they want Bennett to do first.
I have not seen a national reconciliation plan. Have you, Lahav?
I have not, and I also question how important it is. Maybe it's a silent majority, but I think that there's a lot of very loud voices for a long time on the left who were demonizing Netanyahu, and now the right is completely hysterical about him leaving. So if there is a sort of national, I don't know, desire for some kind of consensus unification, it's a silent majority.
I think that it's obviously something that needs to happen, and that will change anyhow with the rhetoric, right? The moment that we don't have a prime minister who's in office who incites to violence and has a party that incites and undermines democratic institutions in Israel, that itself, I think, in my opinion, my humble opinion, will make a difference. But again, let's talk about the bigger picture for a moment. So Sunday is the swearing in. We're assuming at this stage, we're speaking midweek, we're assuming that he will have the 61 hands to vote, right? Nir Orbach has said, I'm with you. No one else is going to fall to the side, Gil?
I'm not aware of anyone wavering at the moment. All of Yamina MKs have been paid off properly. Nir Orbach is going to be our Minister of Settlement Affairs.
Community Affairs.
Community. Oh, thank you very much.
Right. I think it's all communities.
Okay. Well, so he's a minister, though, and, yes. And that should keep him happy.
Was this all because he wanted to be a minister?
I hope not. I hope that there is ideology there. Look, you know that he has been working for Bennett on and off since 2012.
Yeah.
He was his first chief of staff. For him to take his life's work and throw it away and prevent Naftali Bennett from becoming prime minister would be odd.
Which leads me to think that maybe this was a political maneuver to get a portfolio.
I wouldn't discount, though, the pressure that's being put on these people. You know, you yourself have told me stories of going to shul and having people come up to you in shul and, like, say really rude things to you about what's in the paper. And he has protests in front of his house, and it wouldn't surprise me if it's 90% of his shul that's angry at him, as opposed to just one or two people.
Most of the people who complain to me at shul is about Ehud Olmert's column in the Jerusalem Post, but they occasionally complain about other stuff. No, but I think that there was genuine pressure, and I mean, the fact of the matter is that this week, most of the Yamina party is surrounded by security guards, right? Has armed guards that go with them. Nir Orbach does, Idit Silman, Ayala Shaked, Naftali Bennett, Abir Kara.
No,
he doesn't, but he looks like a strong guy.
He's a big guy. I work out with him in the Knesset gym. He's all right.
I don't think anyone would mess with him either way.
Shikli doesn't have.
Well, Shikli's gone over to the good side, right? Shikli, by the way, so Amichai Shikli, just tell us briefly who he is, Gil.
Amichai Shikli is the head of a pre-army academy who was recruited to Yamina because he's not Orthodox. Mm-hmm. He lives in a community founded by the conservative movement in Israel. So he is the religious pluralist voice in Yamina.
And he's the one who's he's going to vote against or in favor of abstaining?
He's
going to
vote against it completely.
But then
he was supposed to be the moderating voice in Yamina and became the opposite.
Is he going to be part of Yamina?
There are people who say that once he gets it out of his system and votes against it, that he will then cooperate with the party from then on. And there are people who say he's going to be like Mirav Mikhaeli was in the Labor Party, as the dissenting voice that doesn't really caucus with the party.
You know, and also I just find that from the moment that he said he was going to vote against this government, his statements against it have gotten more and more and more extreme. So I don't know him. I didn't talk to him, but it sounds to me like someone who's going to play that Mirav Mikhaeli role, because he just keeps like amping up his rhetoric.
So this government is going to be the most diverse government that Israel has ever had, right? With parties on the right, parties on the left, parties in the center, Arab participation, which I think is a very good thing. I think all Israelis should want to see Arab participation, active participation in government, not just in Knesset. But how's it practically going to work, right? So you're going to come to a cabinet meeting and you're going to have the Gaza Strip violence once again on the agenda, right? And you have Naftali Bennett, hardliner. You got Ayala Shaked, hardliner. Gideon Saar, right? But then you got Nitzan Horowitz. You have Mirav Mikhaeli. You have some other people, I'm assuming, from their side.
Not Ram. The Arab party's not in the cabinet.
He's not in the cabinet, right? How do they make these decisions?
The answer is you've got a security cabinet that's purposely six and six, six from the two parties of Yamina and New Hope, and six of all the other parties, which Avigdor Lieberman is not left wing.
So who are the full six? Do you know them?
On the right side,
so you would have... Bennett, Shaked, Gideon Saar, Elkin?
I believe that Elkin is there together with Yoaz Hendel as the three from New Hope.
And then Kahana is the third.
Correct. Former Air Force
pilot. And on the other side, you got Benny Gantz.
You've got the leaders of the parties.
Okay.
Gantz, Lapid, Avigdor Lieberman, Mirav Mikhaeli, Nitzan Horowitz. And then there's an additional one.
There's a clear slant to the right in the security cabinet.
Right.
And Lahav, traditionally, you follow the security cabinet. The prime minister, I guess, and defense minister play a very
dominant
role, right, in what they say. So the Bennett will definitely steer things in the right direction. Do you think that Benny Gantz, who I saw quoted somewhere the other day, that I'm the, what did he say? I'm the carpet, rug,
or
the carpet that Bennett has is sailing on to become prime minister with, or stepping on to become prime minister. Do you think that Benny Gantz will be subservient to the former chief of staff, defense minister, up until now the alternate prime minister who saw himself as becoming prime minister? He's going to listen to Bennett?
You know, if we look at Gantz in the past year, on the kinds of issues that come up in the security cabinet, on most issues, he and Netanyahu weren't really arguing. They didn't really seem to disagree that much on the actual security issues. And so I don't think it'll be that different with Bennett. Where they will likely disagree, and there's already talk about it, is on settlements and things like that. And I think there'll be tension in the cabinet. In theory, they've agreed not to do too much on that front, though.
Gil, tell us a little about Yair Lapid's role in all of this, right? To me, it seems to some extent that he is the real hero of this government, right? He put aside his ego. He was willing to make serious concessions to allow this government to be founded. He's got 17 seats, the largest party, but he's not getting a huge piece of cake. He's giving it up to a lot of the other people. He's saying to Bennett, you go first as prime minister, I'll go second. And he's been talking very much like a statesman, right? As opposed to in the past, where he might have been more of a bigger critic or fighting for different issues. How do you see the role that he's played?
Yair Lapid has been fighting to change his image now since he entered politics. Netanyahu tried to give him from the very beginning an image of being this shallow anchorman who doesn't really have any weight on serious issues.
No substance.
And instead, Lapid has tried to prove that he's deep, he can deal with big issues. And he made a decision for himself that it was more important to him to bring Netanyahu down than for him to come to power.
But what's the strategy?
But also, he realized he can't be elected. He has this glass ceiling, and so the way for him to get elected is to latch onto somebody who can. So he let Gantz go first, which was seen as very noble in a rotation.
This you're talking back in the first election.
Back in the first election.
2019.
And there would be a rotation, technically, where he would then come to power afterward if Blue and White would win the election. But really, he was also doing it for himself, that this would be the way that he could come to power afterward. And now he's doing the same thing with Naftali Bennett. He realized that Naftali Bennett holds the balance of power and he can decide who the prime minister will be. So he decided to show him complete respect from day one and ride his coattails to the premiership where he's supposed to enter in August of 2023.
And I think that Lapid's playing a long game, right? Like, I think Lapid thinks that if Bibi is taken down and there's a new government and then Lapid has a serious role like foreign minister, if there's another election, he will have something that he'll be able to say that he actually did, right? He was finance minister for 5 minutes and he's not considered particularly successful at that. But if he's a good foreign minister, he can come to the next election and say, not only did I take down Netanyahu, but also I've done this and this and this for the country. And he's shown a lot of patience that I think certainly Naftali Bennett doesn't have, but a lot of people in politics that sort of have a goal and they rush into something. And I think that I respect Lapid a lot for realizing, you know, back when Gantz was the leader of Blue and White already, that if he wants to achieve his goal, he has to slowly work towards it and not put
and
himself in the front.
And it's something you don't see. What I find to be so interesting about Yair Lapid is it's the type of conduct you don't see in Israeli politics. You
right.
don't see this graciousness of, no, you go first. Sure, you take this. You don't see even the comment that he made the other day in the Knesset when he was asked about the 28 ministers and 6 deputy ministers that this government's going to have, which has been always something of an issue for Yesh Atid, for his party. They've had as one of their main issues of making a smaller government. He says, look, I couldn't get everything I wanted. Here we failed. What politician says we failed, right? It's the type of talk and conduct that we're so not used to seeing here in Israel.
I think also Lapid was burned in the past because when he first came into the Knesset and he was finance minister and he had a strong, you could call it secularist or you could call it anti-Haredi agenda, and he was really nasty. He said a lot of things that people were very angry about, and I think that he sort of realized that you catch more flies with honey than vinegar.
And Netanyahu tried to burn him. Giving him that post as finance minister was intended to end his political career. Gave him also portfolios that Netanyahu could take credit for any successes, and his people would be blamed for welfare, education, health, and it didn't work. It brought him down a little bit, but Lapid managed to stay on his feet, to his credit.
Gil, you've been sitting in front of you right now is a bunch of pages, stack of papers with the coalition agreement between Bennett, Lapid, and some of the other parties. Give us just the quick highlights, because there's a lot of talk of how you got, like, Meretz has in their coalition agreement, they're going to do, I don't know, some
public transportation
on Shabbat. And then you have, of course, Bennett in his coalition agreement says, well, no changes to the status quo unless I'd agree to it. So there's a lot of these kind of contradictory clauses within all of these different agreements. What practically are they going to be able to do?
practically, what matters is what was decided between Lapid and Bennett, and whatever they decide to do, they're going to do. The other parties don't matter.
So can you give us a couple examples what things might change?
Look, I decided last night to have the lead headline to today's paper be about the Western Wall Agreement, because that is an issue that all seven parties that have ministers in the government
agree on. So let's just remind our listeners, in January of 2016, the cabinet, the government led by Netanyahu, approved a compromise that had been drafted by his people to establish an egalitarian plaza at the Western Wall section, at the southern section, sorry, of the Western Wall, what's otherwise known as Robinson's Arch. A year and a half later, in June of 2017, under pressure from the ultra-Orthodox, Netanyahu rescinded that with a new cabinet, this new government decision to overturn the previous one and canceled the Kotel compromise. And since then, it's been stuck. So you're saying that what you're hearing is that they're going to bring that back to life, basically.
Exactly.
And do it.
And that's something they can say, we did. And that's something that fits with Lapid's ideology of fixing what Netanyahu did.
Okay, that's nice for diaspora jury. Your average Israeli doesn't care.
But there's this issue to the average Israeli that Israel has aligned itself with the right, with the Republicans in the United States and the right around the world, and we've lost these progressive people, and we're not enlightened anymore. We like to be the light into the nations. We like the world to love us. And here, look, this is a statement that people can see, that we're back with the more left-wing, liberal, progressive people all around the world.
What else is in there?
What else is in there is steps to prevent Netanyahu from coming back.
Like a
bill that would say that, first of all, term limits, 8 years or two terms, and possibly in here, the final version will only be submitted on Friday, that if you've served 8 years as prime minister, then you can't run again. You have a cooling off period of 4 years.
So I heard that there's some backtracking on that now.
So they announced it was part of the report last night at 8 p.m. And then by 10 p.m. they were denying it under pressure. Look, in the end, we'll see what's in the final version of the agreement that has not been printed yet.
If that happens, if they've changed, they have to change legislation, right, to pass that term limit bill. Would that mean that Netanyahu going forward it works retroactive too? So it takes into account Netanyahu's past 12 years?
The term limit bill does not. The term limit bill, the 8 years would start over for Netanyahu. He would be able to serve 8 years more. Whereas the bill talked about last night, the reason why it's so controversial is it would specifically prevent Netanyahu from running.
Why would...
We should just say, you have to be a member of Knesset in order to be prime minister. The other ministers don't have to be Knesset members, or prime ministers do. So Netanyahu couldn't run for any national political position. Well, he could run for president in 7 years.
Why would anyone in the Change Coalition not want to see Netanyahu banned or barred from serving as prime minister?
Yamina last night came under pressure to say, oh, you're doing something undemocratic. This is a step against the Israeli right. And they can't be seen as going against the Israeli right, no matter how much they want to get revenge against Netanyahu for everything he's done to them over the years.
In the time that we have left, I want to focus with the three of us on Naftali Bennett. Bennett is reinventing himself to an extent, right? He's moving from the right, where you spoke earlier, Lahav, about the glass ceiling that Lapid had over him. Well, Bennett has also had a glass ceiling whenever he was as the head of a religious party. He was never going to go from there to be prime minister. But now with seven seats minus one, because Shikli, who's voting against, he's going to become prime minister, but he'll have to reinvent himself. The right wing is completely, a lot of his voters feel cheated. They believe what Netanyahu said, that this is the greatest election fraud in the history of Israel. And he will have to find a new base. He will have to find new voters if he wants to survive politically. No?
I'm not entirely sure he's in this for the long haul, Yaakov.
You think it's this term and he goes home?
I think he's achieved his goal. The man has $145 million in the bank before the last exit.
No, not accurate, Gil.
Tell me.
He sold his company in 2005, was it? Or 2004? For $130
million.
$30 million, but he was one of five founders, and the company had been diluted through rounds of investments. So I don't know, never been in high tech.
He
made millions, but if you're a founder of a company, just for accuracy, apparently, we could talk to other founders, you end up with maybe a couple percent.
He's still very wealthy.
He's wealthy. He's well
like,
off.
I believe, the number three wealthiest politician in Israel after Barkat. No, maybe like the number five. Near Barkat's number one.
But forget about money, guys. He's young. He's young. He's not, what is he, 48, 49?
Yeah. 49 years old.
Okay, so he has 2 years. He's going to be 51.
Naftali Bennett has achieved his goal of becoming prime minister at the age of 49. He has a lot of money in the bank. I'm not entirely sure he's focused on running again. He's going to focus now on governing and believe that that's what's going to give him support in the future, that he'll prove that he is
so he's a one-term leader. Prime minister like Biden might be a one-term president.
He could very well be, and anyway, maybe even made that promise to Yelich head for all we know.
Lahav?
Going back to your original question about his like sort of creating a new image for himself, I think that for those paying attention to the things he said over the years, that on social issues, he's always tried to take a fairly sort of uniting tack. He's been moderate. He's not really been aligned with the Haredim, although often under pressure, he's then had to shift to be aligned with the Haredim. In that way, it's not such a big change for him. He just has to shift his focus because he was more focused on security issues before.
Right. But I think that once he's in, I hear you, Gil. And I just don't see, I think this guy has a hunger to continue to be in power. And I think that once you get there and you taste that power, it's going to be difficult to walk away, even though you've gotten there, you've reached the seat, you've sat in it, you've run the country for a couple of years.
But I think you're right to say that he doesn't have that much of a constituency.
Right, he has no constituency.
He's going to have to be like a phenomenal prime minister in order to gain one. Because if there's something that this last election has proven, and also the fact that when he ran an election in 2019, the first in 2019, he didn't even pass the threshold, is that there aren't that many Israelis looking for like a moderate right-wing party.
Well, the question would be, I mean, Gil, once Bibi's out and moves to the opposition, Likud will hold the primaries?
They, by law, would have to hold primaries, but according to the laws within their party, sometime between now and the next election for Knesset, and every time Netanyahu has moved it up in order to catch his potential challengers off guard. And that's something I think the people around the world don't realize enough. They think, okay, Netanyahu's ousted.
Well, no, he's not ousted.
Netanyahu is temporarily sidelined. He, unlike Donald Trump, who has no statutory role, yet definitely casts a shadow over the Republican Party in the United States, Netanyahu will be the head of the Likud, the head of the opposition, will meet with every foreign leader who comes, will be the rights candidate for prime minister at any given point that the current government falls, which is actually the glue that will keep them together. And also, just regarding Bennett, when you have a leader who's been in power for a very long time, the person who tends to follow him remains in his shadow no matter what he does.
So what do you think about the people who talk about within Likud who are supposed to be challenging Netanyahu? There's talk, Yisrael Katz, Nir Barkat, now Yuli Edelstein seems to be throwing his hat into the ring. Is there any chance that they're going to, challenge him soon?
They need to get ready if they're going to. I'm invited to this event of Nir Barkat on Thursday night where he's supposed to show a force, but speak very, very favorably about Netanyahu. And whoever leaked that Yuli Edelstein is meeting with people and saying that Netanyahu has to be replaced, he now will have to be very, very pro-Netanyahu too. Just like you had with Nikki Haley in the United States, said some one thing against Trump and got in trouble and had to come back. I don't see anyone until I see someone publicly saying, not behind closed doors to anyone, I'm going to bring Netanyahu down inside Likud. I won't believe it
happened. Yeah, but that'll be very hard for them to do because he still is extremely popular. The one thing that could change that calculation is the trial if it advances and we reach sometime in the next year.
You hit the nail on the head, Yaakov. The trial will go faster now without him being prime minister. It's going very slow. There's 200 witnesses. The first witness took more than a month. The one thing that could bring this government down is a conviction for Netanyahu because then they lose their glue.
Right. Although legally he could still be prime minister until there's a final conviction and appeal, which would take even more time. But I agree that once there's one conviction by the district court, it'll be very hard for him to come back from that.
And they could change the law. I mean, most of them seem to agree that somebody who is under indictment shouldn't be prime minister.
But that's not part of the law that they're looking to change. They're just doing term limits for the time being.
Right. For now.
Gil Hoffman, Jerusalem Post political correspondent and analyst who's been following all of these elections. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
So we're pleased to have with us Jeremy Salton. Jeremy, you were the head of Anglo operations, English language operations for the Amina Party during the recent campaign. You were also a member of the list. You ran as a candidate for Knesset. You're, I'm guessing, potentially up for a job within the Prime Minister's office. Anything you could tell us about where we could expect to see you?
Well, Yaakov, it's great to be with you. And of course, I want to say hello to all the Jerusalem Post listeners. I'm smart enough, and as you know, Yaakov, I've been in politics long enough to know not to answer that question. So I'm not even going to give you a powerful one. I'll just pass on that one and decline comment.
Okay. Well, we will respect that. But so give us, say, maybe some insights. I think there's probably not a lot of people who know Naftali Bennett out there as well as you do and have been with him for a long time. What should we expect to see on Sunday when this new government is sworn in and takes office?
Well, first of all, there's obviously going to be the exciting speeches before we get to the vote. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of coverage there. One of my favorite things from all votes is just, you know, seeing the key players try to justify their positions. I think it'll be especially interesting to see how it is that, you know, the Haredi parties of UTJ and Shas explain why they're jumping off the cliff. As opposed to their usual position to always try to be in every coalition that they can. I think those will be very interesting ones. But in terms of what we can expect from Bennett, I think it's going to be a speech after the vote that talks about unifying the nation and healing the rifts. And after the very, very difficult situation that we've been in, to be able to try to take Israel into a new chapter, open up a new leaf, and really just take Israel forward and start working for the citizens again. One of the biggest issues that I personally saw with going to a fifth election, and again, being a veteran of election campaigns, is knowing how toxic each election campaign is. Usually you're able to get at least 2 or 3 years in between each election. So even if it gets really hot and the flames go up, there's time for that to cool off before you get to the next one. The situation of possibly having a fifth election in less than, you know, 2.5 years, that's just a situation where beyond the current level of craziness that we're seeing in social media, and unfortunately, of course, outside of a lot of people's houses within the right-wing members of this coalition, that this is a good opportunity to go ahead and look towards the positives. And there are many positives, at least, that I see in terms of what can be done in this new coalition moving forward for the Israeli people.
But, you know, Bennett is not like a centrist figure. He's very solidly right-wing, or at least he has been. He really is someone with a strong ideological position. I mean, how is he going to make it work as this unifier when he is so clearly on one side?
Well, again, I think it talks about the type of coalition that we have here. You know, we've had very large unity coalitions in the past, of course, the Six-Day War having over 100. But what you have here is something you've never had before. You have religious and secular, you have right and left. And yeah, for the first time, you have Jewish and Arab parties. And of course, you also have the situation of native and immigrants here as well. So in terms of the diversity of this coalition, which Naftali is standing at the head of, which he'll be, again, speaking, you know, after the vote, knowing that he's now received the confidence of the parliament, that he'll be in a situation where for the first time you have a religious prime minister in the state of Israel, the first religious leader, rather, of the Jewish people since the Second Temple. You're looking at a situation of the first time that someone is going to be taking the prime minister position who's not either born in Israel or from Europe. You know, this is, you know, when I'm saying from, you know, people from the Ashkenazi European type background compared to his, of course, Ashkenazi, but American background, which is very different. And like you said, he's right wing. And this is the first time that you're having a right wing prime minister that's not coming from the Likud party. So there's a lot of firsts here. And when you have this opportunity to have many firsts, you have the opportunity to be that person who can unify and heal because you don't have the baggage that a lot of those things have in the past. It's an opportunity to try something new.
But do you really think it's possible with such competing values and different parts of this coalition from the left, from the right, the Arab participation, which I think is fantastic, by the way. We should all want active Arab participation in government. But it's going to make it very difficult to get things done, to move forward legislation, big strategic initiatives. It's going to be a big lift every single time you want to do something.
So, you know, the first thing I'll say is in terms of future hurdles is that we have a situation in which there's an understanding because of the veto power here that people who want to go ahead and try to get brownie points by taking something that's outside of the coalition agreements, that they're not going to be able to actually implement that. That's never going to become policy. And I think there's an understanding from the 8-party leaders within this coalition that they are going to do what's needed to keep their party in line to be able to maintain all of the stuff that their constituencies got in the coalition agreements. And that's really the key here, because how are we going to be able to move forward on this stuff? Each one of the constituencies of each one of the 8 parties got something in this agreement. And everyone wants to go ahead and make sure that they're able to see an implementation of the things that were promised to them. So the first thing that you're going to expect in the first 100 days, but I would also say probably in practically throughout the first 6 months, is people trying to make sure that they can get the stuff that they got in the coalition agreements turned into law, turned into policy. That's going to be what they're going to be focused on. Once you're in a situation where everyone's gotten everything that they've wanted to, then you go into that position of, well, this one wants more, that one wants more. But you're going to have this situation where, again, we're hoping being able to go through that first process of making sure everyone gets what they want. And of course, everyone knows there's going to be challenges and hurdles, and it's not going to always be as easy as perhaps some people would like it to be. But you do have this understanding that if you don't compromise, you're not going to get anything. And I think that if we are able to go ahead and show goodwill and work together and make sure that we create as many win-win possibilities as possible, that we're going to be able to see more cooperation once we get to the second part of the government. And if we don't, and I really hope that we don't come into that situation, then we'll have to go ahead and examine our options. And of course, what you have here is many safeguards that are put within the coalition agreements to prevent any side from having a lot of these second thoughts. But if you're in a situation of complete deadlock, if you're not able to go ahead and pass the state budgets, and of course, that's a central theme in terms of the importance of passing this confidence vote and forming this government. The fact that we're the only country around the globe that did not pass a 2020 state budget. As of yet, we're the only ones to not pass a 2021 budget, and we're approaching the halfway point of the year, you know, in terms of the calendar. And no one's even started on a first draft of the 2022 budget. Just the basic elementary aspect of government that you vote for your representatives to go ahead and take your taxes and divide the pie by setting the priorities that were chosen by a majority of the people. That's just the basics. And I really think that given these agreements and the safeguards, that we'll be able to do it and we'll be able to maintain it a lot longer than a lot of people think.
Well, one of the big criticisms of this government from the right, and there's a lot of them, people are very upset. But one thing people talk about is that the Ram party, this Islamist party that's going to be part of the coalition, is really an anti-Zionist party in its ideology. It does not believe that Israel should be the state of the Jewish people. And that actually has policy implications in Israel. And, you know, they, especially when security matters come up, but also on other things, on, I don't know, funding for the Jewish Agency or the World Zionist Organization, or, you know, there's a lot of different things that come up in that way. And it's a coalition with 61 seats, which is difficult to maintain, even when it's mostly homogeneous. So how will Bennett make that work?
Well, first, in terms of the numbers, I remember very well the 2015 government formation, the last time that Netanyahu had what you would say is a normal government. And when that one was formed, it was formed with 61 MKs. It took about a year, but then it ended up growing once Lieberman joined the coalition. I think it's very possible that we will have additional people join this coalition as this continues on. whether it's parties or individuals. So in terms of the numbers, I think as people understand this is a reality, as they see that this is something that's working, I'm actually more optimistic that we're not going to stick at 61. I think as time goes on, that number will increase. In terms of, you know, the differences that you said, and there are.
But doesn't the coalition agreement?
The coalition agreement, of course, talks about it talks about the fact that, you know, you're not going to be kicking parties out of the coalition. As I said, you know, you would have a extension of the coalition. There is safeguards in terms of, for instance, if the Haredim would want to go in. So, yes, there are people on the other side of the equation in the half-half government that we have that would have to sign off on stuff like that. But I think it's in the interest of everybody to be able to see us increase the number of MKs that we have in this coalition, as long as, again, we're able to maintain all of the policy objectives that are very important to all the constituencies of this coalition. I don't think that'll be a problem, but I do want to talk about, you know, what Lav brought up. You know, I don't want to run away from that question in terms of the stuff that's happening here with the Ram Party, with the United Arab List. We have a situation in which I'm hearing a lot of different things. I'm seeing various things put out by the Likud. I think it's very important to say this. All of the agreements that were made are public. There's no side agreements. There's no private agreements. And all of those agreements are going to be made in full transparency to the public. I know that the press has been through various briefings. The full documents will all be released 24 hours, at least probably more than that, before the vote. All of the public will be able to go ahead and look through all of it, see all of the deals. And I think if they go ahead and look at the fine print, they'll notice a lot of things that are very, very different compared to what a lot of the people in both Likud and Smotrich's party are talking about.
Jeremy, Naftali Bennett comes into office on Sunday. What are some of the first things he wants to do? What's on his agenda? Because we can look at the coalition agreements. We're starting to see some of the issues and topics that this government is going to try to tackle, whether it's matters of religion and state, whether it's political or diplomatic affairs and things along those lines. What do you think he's going to set as like maybe his three core issues of policy that will be on the agenda for this government in the 2 years that he's going to serve as prime minister?
Well, I said the first thing and the top of the agenda, the number one priority is to be able to pass the state budgets. It's about time that the Israeli people are able to see a government that knows how to prioritize and decide how they're going to allocate their funds. You know, this is just the elementary reason of why it is that we're going into this coalition, so that we can pass a budget, we can get back to normal business and just, you know, have a normal lives again without worrying about if the municipal governments are going to fill in missing days of schools in certain areas, mm-hmm. depending on your socioeconomic level. So that's the number one goal that I see moving forward. In terms of the other goals, I'm sure you saw in the coalition agreements, there are various pieces of legislation which are timed. This one needs to be done within 60 days. This one needs to be done within 120 days. There are certain things that we definitely prioritize over other items. It's a situation where, you know, I understand people are looking for those hot button items. You know, they want to know what's going on with all these type of external issues, whether it's the Palestinians or Iran or a lot of those other things. It's a boring answer, Yaakov, but the truth is, like every other government in the post-corona era, you know, most of what we're going to be focusing on are domestic issues, economic issues. You know, there are different things that I'm very excited about within the coalition agreements, which I'm sure you saw in terms of, you know, creating new universities, creating new hospitals, being able to upgrade our infrastructure. There are a lot of things here that are perhaps going to be boring, but you want to know what, Yaakov? I think we could go with some boring. I think after a lot of the excitement that we've had, we can go back to normal and, you know, talk about a lot of these regular issues. Throughout the campaign, people would ask me, why are you talking about health? Why are you talking about education? Why are you talking about corona? Why are you talking about the economy? Why don't you talk about these really big issues? Look, those big issues are there, Yaakov. No one's saying that they're not. And obviously, they're going to be addressed. And we know that Naftali Bennett is a guy who knows how to address those issues. And his values are very much known. And his positions are as well. And of course, we're going to take into account Yair Lapid and everyone else in this coalition. But what the Israeli people care about right now, if you're talking about voters on the street, if I look at messages that I've got, and of course I've got plenty against the government, but I've gotten plenty for the government, no one here is talking about those big issues. They're talking about the need to get back to normal. And that's what this government's going to be about.
Interesting. Jeremy, the idea of what Bennett's going to do. So when you talk about the big issues, right? So Palestinians, for example, you're saying that's not something that we should expect to see big movement on. Israeli-U.S. ties, we should expect to see Yaakov, more of the same.
On Palestinian, you know, issues, and are we supposed to pretend the Palestinians did not cancel their elections? Are we supposed to pretend that there's some sort of reunification between Gaza and Judea and Samaria? Are we supposed to, you know, suddenly understand that they're going to drop their ICC case against us? Like, I understand that there's a lot of interest. You have a new prime minister, a new sheriff in town, that people want to understand if there's going to be a change of policy on the Israeli side. But there's absolutely nothing but stagnation on the Palestinian side. And it doesn't matter if, you know, you had, I would say, you know, Nitzan Horovitz as prime minister of Israel right now. I don't think there's really much of an expectation or even a capability to be able to really do things within the realm of big time change the way that certain people's expectations might be at this point.
So, Jeremy, just before we say goodbye, just give us, if you can, you know, someone who spent a long time alongside at Naftali Bennett's side through campaigns and through ministries. What would give us a takeaway, a story behind the scenes? What's he like?
I mean, he's just the best decision maker that I think I've seen. What you want to know is that your country is in good hands. You want to know that there's somebody who gets up in the morning and actually wants to get to work very early. I remember one story where I was his first meeting. And he had gotten there an hour before that just so that he could, you know, do laps around the ministry. You know, this is a guy who's working 24/7. His multitasking capabilities are quite known to anyone around him. I can tell you like this, with Naftali Bennett sitting in the prime minister's chair, every single one of the Israeli citizens can sleep very peacefully throughout the night.
So that's a really good concluding remark. But since I'm back on the call, I wanted to ask about the really vitriolic attacks we've been seeing. I mean, you slightly touched on it, but I just think that really levels of attack, verbal attacks so far, thank God, on the members of Yamina and total demonization of Bennett. Where do you think we go from here? How can Bennett sort of, I mean, it's not Bennett's fault, but as prime minister, he will have to sort of bring down the flames.
But again, that, you know, that's why I was talking about the need for unity. That's why I was talking about the need to heal. And that's also why I tell people who do criticize, you know, this government, tell us your fears, tell us your issues. Again, we have veto power. If there's something that's bothering you, let us know. We can take care of it. I think that people, and this does bother me, since obviously I'm one of the people who's receiving it, and I'm not receiving anything close to what the MKs are receiving, is that what's going on now is different than anything that I've seen before. And just to explain that, this is the first time in Israel's history where regular MKs who are not, you know, an opposition leader, they're not a minister, they're not Speaker of the House. You have four MKs who are regular MKs who are under severe security protocols. Both Naftali and Ayelet are on security level number 5 in terms of the Shabak. Things are really crazy. I mean, I spoke about in a different interview just the situation when we had that crucial faction meeting on Sunday where we had to make the decision if we were going to go with Yesh Atid or not. There was, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 policemen securing us. There was, of course, the Shabak details from all of the people who are under security. And there were still people who were able to somehow make it into that building. It's just crazy the type of stuff that I've seen. the kind of stuff that the MKs are talking about. And because you have that stuff in the air, because you have those things happening, there is a real, real need to be able to heal the nation, to be able to just get everyone back together and to stop with the hate and just figure out a way to agree and disagree in a respectful manner within a normal discourse and just tone the flames down.
Jeremy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure to be with the J-Post.
Welcome, everyone, to our favorite segment, the Tweet of the Week. This week's tweet comes from Mayan Jaffe Hoffman, the head of strategy for the Jerusalem Post, tweeting on something that's been an interesting sort of side story to this whole, to all the political events lately. She wrote, "Evangelicals, Christians distance themselves from attack on Naftali Bennett." Quote, "Christian Zionists have had a relationship with every prime minister since David Ben-Gurion. That will not change," unquote, said Christians United for Israel spokesman Ari Morgenstern in a statement first made to the Jerusalem Post. Now, we have to give some background
context
here. Yes, which is that last week, a couple days after it was announced that Lapid and Bennett were going to form a government, Mike Evans, the head of the Friends of Zion Museum, and a big evangelical figure here in Israel, at least, he wrote this scathing, nasty letter to Naftali Bennett and then a blog post. The letter was erased, so I didn't read the letter. I've only read quotes, but I read the blog post, so I can tell you what it says there, which is basically that Netanyahu was chosen by God to be prime minister, which is something that Evans has been saying for decades, and that the Israelis who want him out are saying, crucify him, crucify him. And that evangelicals...
comparing Netanyahu to Jesus Christ, right?
Exactly. What he's saying is, Netanyahu is Jesus and the Jews are killing Jesus. And also that evangelicals... He will make sure that evangelicals will do everything they can to fight this new Israeli government. And then there was also some bizarre comment there about German Jews being too arrogant and that he smells the smoke from Auschwitz.
Can I just read one paragraph from the letter to Naftali Bennett? "You betrayed the very principles that a generation gave their blood for and died for. You want to be in bed with the Muslim Brotherhood and leftists. God have mercy on your soul. You're a pathetic, bitter little man obsessed in murdering Netanyahu, that you're willing to damage the state of Israel for your worthless cause." Right?
I mean, that's really nasty. But in the blog post, I felt like it was anti-Semitic. Like, if you're accusing Jews of killing Jesus, like, that's, you know.
But the thing here is it talks to a bigger, deeper issue, right? Which is about Israeli evangelical ties, right? We know that Netanyahu has been a champion of those relations. We recently heard Netanyahu's former ambassador to Washington, Ron Dermer, who stirred a bit of a controversy himself with comments that he made that were, I think, misquoted and misinterpreted.
About, yeah, they were taken out of context.
Taken out of context about, but he did say that Israel needs to invest a lot more in the evangelical community in the United States. So they are important for Israel. And you know, but on the other hand, we've pushed back from Kufi, like you mentioned, you quoted Mayan's tweet, that they say, no, we actually stand by whoever the government of Israel is going to be.
Also, Joel Rosenberg was like a prominent evangelical figure who writes about Israel. He wrote an article where he brought together like a bunch of different evangelical voices saying like, no, it's okay. Evangelicals will still have a relationship with Israel. And so I think that the bottom line, and that's important, but I think that Mike Evans clearly is reflecting something that's going on, that people feel very attached to Netanyahu specifically.
Exactly. And I think that that's what's interesting, is that there's around the world, like we spoke about those people who we met in Dubai who were saying to us, how are you getting rid of Netanyahu? There is this strong base, and he is just extremely popular in different communities around the world, and including among evangelicals.
I don't think this is the case with the people who spoke to us in Dubai, but I think to some extent it's the case with the evangelicals, and in a different way, it's the case with a lot of diaspora Jews, where they look at Israel as an icon and forget that this is a real country with real people living here, and we have to decide, you know, democratically what is the good of this country and not just the people who support us from outside. And we appreciate that support and we want to cultivate ties with those people, but in the end, you and I and the other 9 million people in Israel, we're the ones who have to live here.
Right. I've always said that there's the geographic location that you live in is how you're going to look at something. So when Israelis, for example, looked at the United States and looked at Trump, they loved him because of the different things that he did for Israel. Moving of the embassy, recognition of Jerusalem, recognition of Golan Heights, pulling out of the 2015 nuclear deal, etc. When Americans looked at it, they could, you know, they didn't like Trump because they were looking at domestic issues. Right. Same thing with Netanyahu. A lot of Israelis look at the domestic way that he formulates policy and the way he does things. On the other hand, people from outside of Israel see someone who's strong against Iran, brought vaccines, you know, tough, talks tough, good presence, meets with world leaders, but they're not seeing all the rest of the picture. And that could be also what contributed to this rift among the evangelicals. I think it's been healed for now, but it'll be interesting to see, for example, what Bennett does.
We should note that Evans did apologize, even though he still opposes this government. He called a press conference in the Knesset yesterday and he apologized to Naftali Bennett for the tone he used.
I'd be willing to guess that he's not getting an invite that quickly to the prime minister's office under Naftali Bennett, but time will tell. Thanks for joining us. See you next week.